We get things underway this hour by welcoming you to the show, well, quite simply, one of the best writers in America. If we lived in a just and fair universe, publications would be fighting for him. He would be on radio shows and television programs all over America. It is our good fortune that most of these people suck, and so we get to welcome David Roth back to Downtown.
That is the nicest way to say unemployed blogger that I could possibly imagine. Thank you so much, Rich.
Well, listen, you're unemployed by choice. Yes.
I was busy this week. I did a lot of writing this week, which was good. I feel better when I do that.
You did indeed.
I'm just sitting at home.
Before we talk about your writing, I'm just curious. Are you having a problem flushing the toilet? Do you need to do multiple flushes? Because the president says this is a problem.
I just finished reading the full quote to my wife before Carrie called, and I don't say this sort of thing lightly because I, you know, like everybody else, I get way more Trump in the monitors than anyone needs. I think it's the funniest thing that he's ever said. Everybody knows how he does stuff, where it's like if he takes a number that he heard, like over time that number, it's like compound interest. So that it's like if someone was like, yeah, like this is our profits went up by 2%. And then like the next day, you know, it's like 4% and then it's 16% and then it's, you know, and so on and so forth. In this case, he's trying to make some sort of point about fuel efficiency. Water. First it was fuel efficiency, then it was water efficiency standards. Whatever it is, he claims that people have to flush the toilet 10 or 15 times now because of the PC police or whatever. And it is... just the image of someone, it takes not a long time, but I mean, you know how toilets work. The thing has to fill back up. The tank has to fill back up before you can flush it again. That takes like a minute. So just the idea of spending 15 minutes trying to get some satisfaction and to get back to work is really like, I don't know if it's a window into what his workday is like.
He can take that kind of time.
It is. I mean, I don't want to talk about whether or not the president is hard on toilets or not. And I don't think your listeners want to hear us talk about that.
Well, I don't know about that.
Well, all right. I don't know either. It's your show. He definitely is. And this is really a remarkable. I mean, I think it's like also it's perfectly Trump in the sense that like he has an embarrassing experience and he clogs a toilet and his first thought is like something's wrong with the water.
Yes. Yes.
And then the second thought is like, how did the libs make this happen? Which is incredible, even by the standards of accountability that he ordinarily applies to himself. It's just, I don't know. I mean, whatever. I know how you get there if you're Donald Trump. It just would be very difficult for another.
I just think, you know, Monroe Doctrine, Gettysburg Address, the Great Society, the New Deal, ask not what your country can do for you. I got to flush this damn toilet 15 times to go down.
15 times. And that's Obama. That's all on Obama.
Oh, yes. Think yes. Yeah.
There's a great moment at the... I wanted to read the quote aloud to my wife because it's wonderful writing. I mean, it's just kind of got... It's not Mammoth, but like if... if Harold Pinter had some sort of like closed brain, traumatic brain injury sort of thing. There's a pivot at the end of it that I'd like to... Do you mind if I read a little bit of it?
Oh, I would love nothing more.
All right. I have it up here on this screen because I just finished reading it. So he's talking now about washing your hands. You can't wash your hands practically. There's so little water comes out of the faucet. And the end result is you leave the faucet on and it takes you much longer to wash your hands. You end up using the same amount of water. So we're looking very seriously at opening up the standard. And there may be some areas where we'll go the other route, desert areas. But for the most part, you have many states where they have so much water that it comes down. It's called rain. They don't know what to do with it. So we're going to be opening up that, I believe, and we're looking at changing the standards very soon. And that's a little bit like the light bulb, where you get a bulb that's better for much less money. We go back, but you have the other alternative. And you'll keep the other alternative with sinks and showers, et cetera, too. But that's been a big problem. All right, now I'm speaking in my own voice. The light bulb thing, unexpectedly, was the biggest laugh line for
yes.
My life, because I thought all of it is good. But just that, the moment where you can see him making that pivot, you know, getting the sort of NBA Jam turbo boost where suddenly he's on fire and dunking through the rafters. really is magical to watch.
I watched.
Also, It's Called Rain is fantastic.
Oh yes, yeah. I watched the great Peter Sellers movie. Being There was on cable a couple of weeks ago, and yes, hearing you read that, Chauncey Gardner is our president.
Yeah, it was a much there's obviously that's a satire, but it feels so much more benign in that way. But it is the same sort of thing where like you have to kind of parse whatever it is he's saying. And in this case, you're parsing it to be like, what's this guy's bathroom life like? But in all of it, you have to do so much work just to extract any meaning from what's coming out of his mouth.
We're talking with David Roth on Downtown. Carrie, you wanted to weigh in on the bathroom?
I'm so sorry, guys.
The part of the quote that just kills me the most is the rain part, that he thinks that rain happens because there's too much water in that state.
Yeah, it's fast. His understanding of, there's a couple of things about it that are great. It's Called Rain, tonally, when he says it, it's a thing that he does. He has these kind of weird, like, Valley Girl intonations that he'll put on sometimes at random, which are a delay. But in this case, it's like if you ever had, like, a very young child explain something to you, where they're like, no, that's a brontosaurus,
yeah,
by the way.
It's called rain. You
know, this weird, like, superiority of it, where you're sort of like, you guys probably haven't heard of it because you're in the media. You don't know anything. All you want to do is talk about how bad Trump is.
If you just sweep the forest, these fires wouldn't happen.
Gosh, it's the same thing. And there's a little, I know too much about this guy at this point. I feel really bad for just dumping this on you. But there's a callback to the forest stuff in this where he talks about they have too much water and it's rushing out to sea and you can't capture it. That's like earlier in the little monologue that he had.
Uh-oh.
And everybody sort of, you know, when he was doing that, that was first he was saying there's not really a drought in California. All the water's going out to the ocean and you got to stop it and you got to make the water go back or whatever. And it was extremely confusing just on its merits because you're sort of like, well, you want to turn like put the rivers in reverse? Like, where are we going with this one, sir? It has to do with, like, I think, you can usually find like the germ of a thing that like maybe he was told once in there. And then everything just, it's like the way that like a pearl winds up in an oyster. You know, this little irritant of nonsense lodges itself in his spongy mind. And then over time, it just like forms into this impenetrable thing.
You wrote a wonderful piece for New York Magazine about talking politics and the world at large at Thanksgiving and in general, our political discourse. And I love this quote. Trump is both the main character and the primary audience for everything that happens in national politics. That is perfect.
Thank you. Yeah, it's an annoying thing, too, because there's no way to write about it without being a part of that. But like, I think everybody could be, not just for reasons of emotional well-being or like self-care or whatever, but I think everyone could deal with like maybe 15% less Trump every day. You know, just replace that with anything else.
Okay, then. Then we're going to do that.
Yeah, we're going to look into it. I think very strongly.
Yeah, we have some people. People are talking about it. So let's.
But I think that like with that, it's like the TV stuff, the element of. Especially with the impeachment this week, like, and I wrote that piece, I filed it on like Tuesday night, and then we were sort of updating it as more things kept happening, and it was always, you know, which is, it's good, you know, it came out and it's current, but they weren't doing anything today, so it'll stay, you know, current for another few hours, but there's always some new, like, wrinkle in the news cycle that's basically, like, he saw something on TV and he got annoyed and did a tweet about it, and now they're covering the tweet on TV and he's annoyed about the coverage of the tweet. And it's all just, like, it's all about this one old guy getting upset every day. And there's all this other stuff happening, you know, some of it important, some of it terrible and criminal, and yet, like, somehow it winds up that none of it matters as much as, like, this guy walking by a TV, you know, that has a picture of him on it, and he doesn't think it's a flattering angle.
So I have to ask you this question, David, because, again, these are two topics that you may know better than anyone else in America.
There's no way that this is accurate. But what?
The Wilpons' ownership of the Mets, is that a microcosm of Trump's America?
No, that actually maybe is a thing that I also know as much about or care as much about. I can't really tell with the Wilpons. I think that there's like, so they are purportedly selling the team. I will believe it when I see it, but I did get to write about them selling the team, which is authentically a story that I never thought I would get to write. I think that there's an element of, you know, sort of like Trumpy America in there, but they're kind of, they're unique to this, this region, especially that there's like a type of like New Yorker that made their money in like the 70s. It was just sort of like, you know, they got in at like a low point in the market, you know, and then New York turned back into New York and suddenly they're like, oh, wow, I own all these parking garages and somehow I'm worth $5 billion. And the Wilpons are kind of, you know, like that. But there's the guy that bought the Dodgers years ago, Frank McCourt, was another guy that like had a bunch of, I think it really was parking lots in his case that like he built his fortune on. And that's,
right.
That's an accident. You know, and for the Wilpons, it's similar in the sense that, like, you know, Trump was born into money and really hasn't gotten anything right since, like, 1980 in terms of, like, the actual real estate decisions that he's made. But he did get, you know, some things right back in the day. But, like, the way that it works is once you have that money, you just kind of get to keep it unless you really, really screw it up. And, you know, even Trump couldn't manage to do that. He did his best. And this is one of our best bad decision makers that we've probably ever seen, and he didn't do it.
So what would be
somehow I think did.
What would be better for the Mets, to have the Wilpons hang on or for this Steve Cohen, who sounds like an interesting character as well?
It's really, see, this is the part where it starts to feel like a microcosm to me, because the choice is between, so is it these like unpleasable, grouchy, mediocre guys? Do they stay in charge and keep messing things up the same way they always have? Or is it this just finance creature from Connecticut who has billions of dollars, has committed a bunch of, I mean, like, just like found liable for like many serious financial crimes and then was never really punished for it and he can't trade anymore, I guess. But like somehow that's the more sympathetic option here, because we haven't seen how he's going to screw the team up, and maybe he'd actually spend, or maybe he'd be able to spend in a way that the Wilpons aren't. So it's weird. Ethically, it's like, you know, there's not really a right answer, but this is the problem with, you know, to make it too globally about politics or whatever, but this is what inequality sort of feels like, right? Where you're choosing what kind of rich person you want to mess with your leisure time, like, which is not fun.
No. David Roth is with us here on Downtown. I have to ask you about this. You're a big NBA guy. The state of Maine, not known for producing NBA players. I can't think of any in history. And yet, Brett Brown, Steve Clifford, Rick Carlisle, Jim Boylan, four NBA head coaches, all either from Maine or with ties to Maine. How is that possible, and what does it possibly mean? And I ask you that as a guy with his own Maine family connections.
Yeah, so I love this question. I also love hearing Brett Brown especially. It's like being at my wife's place for Christmas, you know, just to hear that guy on TV talking about like ideas and stuff. It's just great. You never hear that on TV. So I really sort of, it's all part of they're all part of the Popovich coaching tree to a certain extent, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that Pop is interesting. Like, I mean, he seems like the most interesting person in basketball to me. Just, like, very, very smart and clearly very much his own man. And I know that the connection I have with Popovich is that he was the basketball coach at the very small, athletically undistinguished Division III college that I went to in Southern California. And then went from there, got an assistant job, and then eventually winds up taking over in San Antonio. And I think that there's something about him that, like, I mean, they have always had, like, some ex-players on the bench, but not to the extent I think that other teams have. Like, I think he finds weirdos. Like, he finds people that would otherwise be overlooked because of where they're coaching or what they're like. And, you know, it's hard to say that he hasn't done a good job picking them. Like, all of those guys have really, you know, to varying degrees, have worked out very well. Boylan, I guess the jury's still out on. Where in the state are those guys from? I know that Brown is like a Lewiston kid or something.
South Portland. He grew up here. Steve Clifford grew up here. And Rick Carlisle played at the University of Maine before he transferred to Virginia to play with Ralph Sampson. And Jimmy Boylan wasn't from Maine, but he also played at the university.
Yeah. The only Maine-born guy I can think of that came close to the NBA was Nick Kinner Medley.
Right, right.
And he was a good player, and he made a lot of money playing in Europe. I had a nice experience last Christmas talking to guys like a former coworker of my father-in-law, who's like a youth basketball coach in Portland at Chevres, and just like talking about like guys that had played for the Red Claws and like Maine high school basketball stuff. And it was a very like kind of a pure engagement with somebody. Like it was, not a dude that, different age than me, different, career. And yet, like, it was a very sort of solid way to bond with somebody over being like, yeah, Nick Kinner Medley was pretty good, right? And he's like, yeah, he was. It's just very, like, authentic and nice.
Absolutely. Hey, it's always great to talk with you, David. We appreciate you making some time for us here this afternoon, and hope you have a wonderful holiday season. We'll catch up with you in the new year, I hope, if we all survive.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. Back and, it's always fun to come on.
Hope the toilets work well for you.
It's such a nice send-off. Thank you.
It's David Roth. Wow. You're on Downtown. Bye, David.